Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, John Russell and Ashley Thompson explore terms you might hear in discussions of American politics in the English grammar teaching series, Everyday Grammar. Later, Barbara Klein, Robert Bostick, and Jack Weitzel bring us the latest in the ongoing American history series, Making of a Nation. This time, continuing their examination of immigration in the United States in the 1800s. But first, this report with help from Katie Weaver, which looks at questions surrounding Prince Harry and his wife Meghan's decision to leave their positions in the British royal family.
Britain's Prince Harry and his wife Meghan have announced they will step back from senior positions in the royal family. The couple said they hope to become financially independent and create a new charity while continuing some royal duties. The move came as a surprise to the British royal family. Hours after the announcement appeared on Instagram, Buckingham Palace released a short statement. It said, discussions with Harry and Meghan were at an early stage, and that such complex issues take time to work out. British media did not like the idea either. The Daily Mirror called the announcement a shocking disregard for the Queen. The Sun described the decision as Megxit. The word is a play on Brexit, a common term for Britain's withdrawal from the European Union. It also raises questions about how the couple will earn a living, who will pay for their security, and what their new positions will involve.
In their announcement, Harry and Meghan said they plan to divide their time between Britain and North America. Meghan was born in Los Angeles, California, and grew up in Hollywood. Harry and Meghan spent the last 6 weeks of 2019 in Canada. Their first official appearance of 2020 was a trip to Canada House in London, home of Canada's diplomatic mission to Britain. They will continue to base themselves at Frogmore Cottage in the grounds of the Queen's Windsor Castle while in Britain. The property was recently repaired at a cost of £2.4 million, or $3.13 million, by taxpayers. The couple also made clear that they expect the government to continue to pay their security costs. This is required by the Home Office, which is responsible for security of the royal family. The cost of the security is not publicly available information, but it is estimated to cost hundreds of thousands of British pounds a year.
The couple said on their new website that they are seeking financial independence from the royal family's funding, known as the Sovereign Grant. This is government money that covers the ongoing costs related to daily life and travel. The couple said the grant represented about 5% of money needed to run their official office. They did not say if they will give up the remaining 95%, which comes from Prince Charles's centuries-old private estate. The couple's new website, Sussex Royal, does not say exactly how they plan to fund themselves in the future. Last year, it was reported that Harry would be executive producer of a film on mental health for Apple's video streaming service. And Royal writer Penny Junor suggested that Meghan, who starred in the television show Suits, might restart her acting career. The couple has not said they would give up their royal names, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. And their website noted that other royal family members have kept their titles while earning money in other ways.
Harry and Meghan married in May 2018 in a ceremony in Windsor Castle. Their marriage was considered, at the time, to be a sign of a more modern monarchy. Their son, Archie, was born in May 2019. The family's relationship with the media has worsened quickly over time as they struggled to deal with the pressure, criticism, and scrutiny. Harry described the media's treatment of his wife as bullying, and likened it to that of his mother before her death. His mother, Princess Diana, died in a car crash in France in 1997 while being chased by paparazzi.
Harry and Meghan announced they plan to greatly change media access to their official events. They will no longer take part in the traditional Royal Rota system, which is an agreement providing access for royal correspondents. The Royal Rota system permits access to their appearances and events by official correspondents. These correspondents take photographs and videos, which they then share with others in the media. Now, the couple said their plan is to speak directly to the public through social media. They plan to deny automatic access to some royal correspondents. The change may make them more of a target for paparazzi photographers, who will no longer worry about losing access to official events if they are already excluded. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Pete Musto.
The United States will hold a presidential election in November of 2020. From now until then, you are likely to hear or read many reports about the things U.S. politicians say. Sometimes, the reports or politicians' statements will have words that carry a somewhat different meaning than what you might think. One example is minority. It is a noun, but sometimes people use it like an adjective, as in the term minority groups. This seemingly simple word will be the subject of our report today.
The word minority has a long history. The Google Ngrams search engine shows it first appeared in the English language somewhere around the year 1510. The Online Etymology Dictionary notes that minority comes from the Middle French word minorité. By the 1530s, the English term meant state or condition of being smaller. But it does not really carry that meaning anymore. Minority slowly took on new meanings during the 1700s. By the 19th century, minority generally had two meanings. Webster's Dictionary of 1828 notes one was the state of being under age. The other was the smaller number, as the minority of the Senate or House of Representatives, opposed to majority. By the beginning of the 21st century, minority had taken on more meanings. Webster's New World Dictionary, 4th edition, for example, lists four main meanings. One of them is a racial, religious, ethnic, or political group smaller than and differing from the larger controlling group in a community, nation, etc. But such definitions do not always line up with how Americans use terms, as we will see.
John McWhorter is an American expert on language. In his book, Words on the Move, McWhorter writes that Americans often think of specific groups of people when using the term minority. In the minds of American English speakers, minorities are considered to be Black and Latino people, he adds. A report on the television program CBS This Morning provides an example of what McWhorter is talking about. The title of this 2016 video is Clinton and Sanders Fight for Minority Votes in Milwaukee Debate. Let us listen to some of the report. Notice that it takes note of only one kind of minority in the United States.
The debate was in Wisconsin, but the candidates were clearly focused on the next primary in South Carolina, where African Americans could decide the outcome.
In his book, McWhorter noted that the term minority feels forced when applied to other groups, even when they, too, constitute numerical minorities of the population. In other words, the term minority often carries a much more narrow meaning than what the recent dictionary definition might suggest. But here is an important point to consider. Minority carries this narrower meaning when Americans are talking about local or national issues. They might mean something closer to the dictionary definition when talking about groups of people outside the United States. Here is an example. Imagine two statements by an American political candidate. The first statement is about U.S. college admissions. The politician might say,
I believe we need to do all we can to encourage minorities to apply to colleges.
In this statement, our make-believe politician is probably using minority in the way that McWhorter wrote about. The politician is probably not talking about Americans of Asian ancestry, although they do make up about 5 or 6% of the U.S. population. The politician is also probably not referring to other kinds of minority groups in the country, Jewish people, for example. Now, imagine our politician is making a point about U.S. foreign policy. The politician might say,
I believe America should send aid to the Kurds and other minorities in the Middle East.
In this case, the politician would be referring to a broader, more extensive idea of what minority means. In other words, small groups that do not make up the majority, whether that be along religious, racial, or other lines.
Today, we took you on a journey of one word, from its birth in English to its modern usage in American politics and the news. We showed you that a commonly heard noun, can carry slightly different meanings, and that its meanings have grown and changed over time. The next time you are reading or watching a story about American politics, ask yourself about the language that the speaker uses. Are there some terms, nouns, verbs, or adjectives he or she uses often? Do you think the speaker might be using the term in a way that matches what you see in the dictionary? If not, what might explain the difference? Asking yourself these kinds of questions will improve your understanding of American English, as well as American politics and culture. And that's Everyday Grammar. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In our last program, we told you how the flow of immigration to the United States began to change in the 1880s. Before then, most of the immigrants came from Central and Northern Europe, from Britain, Ireland, Germany, and the Scandinavian countries. The largest number came from Britain. They found it easy to settle in a country that, until 1776, was a collection of British colonies. The newcomers from Britain shared the same language with the Americans and many of the same traditions. Some of these early immigrants were skilled workers who found good jobs in American industry. Others were farmers who came to America for free land. Robert Bostick and Jack Weitzel continue the story of immigration in the United States.
After 1880, the flood of immigration from Northern and Central Europe began to fall. Now, most immigrants were coming from Eastern and Southern Europe, from Russia, Poland, Romania, Italy, Greece. These new immigrants were different from those who came earlier. Most did not speak English. Most were poor farmers who had few special skills. Most had little or no education. They were, however, good workers. They did not protest working long hours for low pay. They did not demand better working conditions. They usually refused to join labor unions or take part in strikes.
American factory owners were pleased with the new immigrants. They gave them jobs formerly held by higher-paid American workers. The owners asked the new workers to write letters to friends still in the old country, urging them to come to America. And they came by the hundreds of thousands to take jobs in steel factories in Pennsylvania and the coal mines of West Virginia. They worked in the lumber camps of Michigan and in the stockyards and the meatpacking plants of Chicago. American workers then began to protest as their jobs were filled by immigrants who were happy to work for less money.
The protests were especially bitter on the Pacific coast, where thousands of Chinese immigrants were settling in California. The Chinese arrived there after 1850 to help build Western railroads. After the railroads were completed, these Chinese newcomers turned to other jobs. More came every year. By the 1870s, California's political leaders were demanding an end to further immigration from China. In 1882, Congress passed a law that barred Chinese immigration for 10 years. The law was extended for another 10 years, then made permanent.
The immigration law of 1882 put other limits on immigration. It closed the country to criminals, the mentally ill, and persons who could not support themselves. Later, others were added to this list. Persons with diseases, anarchists, alcoholics. This, however, did not greatly reduce immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe, and opponents of immigration demanded stronger action. Some proposed a literacy test. Immigrants would have to show that they could read and write. An immigrant who could not would not be permitted to enter the country.
Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts urged Congress to pass such a law. In a Senate speech, Lodge said, "If we care for the welfare, the wages, or the standard of life of American working men, we should take immediate steps to limit foreign immigration. There is no danger to our working men from the coming of skilled workers or of trained and educated men. But there is a serious danger from the flood of unskilled, ignorant foreign labor. This labor not only takes lower wages, but accepts a standard of living so low that the American working man cannot compete with it." Senator Lodge continued, "A literacy test will bear very lightly, if at all, upon English-speaking immigrants or Germans, Scandinavians, and French. The races which would suffer most under a literacy test would be those with which the English-speaking people have never united, and who are most different from the great majority of the people of the United States." Congress passed the proposal. President Cleveland, however, vetoed it. He said the nation had nothing to fear from immigrants who could not read or write. He said there was greater danger from some of the educated immigrants who urged violence and anarchy. It took a number of years before Congress was able to pass a law demanding a literacy test for immigrants.
Another problem troubled President Cleveland: high tariffs, taxes on imports. Soon after his election, Cleveland decided to learn what he could about the tariff. "I'm sorry to say," said Cleveland, "but the truth is, I know nothing about the tariff." Cleveland studied all the information he could find about the tariff. He found that the tariff was used not only to get money for the government, but to protect American industry from foreign competition. The tariffs had been raised so high that they were producing more money than the government needed. Cleveland decided that high tariffs were wrong. He told other Democratic leaders that he would try to get them reduced. The politicians warned him not to try. They said he would only lose the support of businessmen. They said he would need campaign money from business if he expected to be elected president again. But Cleveland rejected their advice. He said, "What is the use of being elected or re-elected if you don't stand for something?"
So, late in 1887, Cleveland sent a tariff message to Congress. He said it was wrong to raise more tax money than the government needed. When this happens, he said, money is withdrawn from the people's use and kept in the public treasury where it does no good. It threatens the economy and invites dishonest attempts to use the money for private interests. The government, he said, received most of this unnecessary tax money from tariffs. He said the present tariff laws were vicious, unfair, and illogical. He said they raised the prices of all imported goods which could be taxed. They also led American manufacturers to raise their prices as high as those charged for imported goods. Cleveland said some men had become rich because protective tariffs let them charge high prices. He noted that American businessmen liked to talk about the strength and success of American industry. But he said that when the question of the tariff is raised, businessmen claim that industry is weak. They say they cannot compete with low-priced foreign products.
Cleveland said he did not propose that all tariffs be ended. He said some were needed to raise money, and he said some industries could not exist unless they were protected by tariffs. But he said tariffs should not let some industries make huge profits. Cleveland warned that it would be far better to make safe, careful, and intelligent changes in the tariff laws now. Otherwise, he said, there might come a time when an angry public would demand radical and sweeping changes.
The House of Representatives moved quickly to pass a moderate bill that would reduce many of the tariffs. The legislation, called the Mills Bill, was exactly what Cleveland wanted. But the bill ran into trouble in the Senate, where Republicans had control. Senator William Allison, a Republican from Iowa, proposed a different tariff bill. It was one that would increase tariffs, not reduce them. The Senate debated the tariff question for months, and since it was 1888, a presidential election year, the tariff became an important election issue. The Democrats promised low tariffs that would mean lower prices for the people. The Republicans defended high tariffs, which they said were necessary to protect American industry and labor. The Democrats nominated Grover Cleveland for another 4-year term. The Republicans held their nominating convention 2 weeks later.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.